DBHDD is reminding Georgians to ask their doctor about alternatives to opioid pain medication. Alternatives such as over-the-counter medications and physical therapy can be used to manage pain. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Thanks for listening to the Political Rewind podcast. Be sure to like and follow us and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I feel particularly lucky today because I get to start a brand new week here on Political Rewind with just a terrific panel of analysts who I'm very excited to talk to in just a couple of minutes. There are a number of debates going on today and throughout tomorrow. You can look at a list of all of them by going to gpb.org because we broadcast the debates that are produced actually by the Atlanta Press Club. But some important ones up ahead: lieutenant governor candidates on both sides of the aisle, secretary of state candidates, and others will be happening today and tomorrow. Let's get right to this panel of ours today. Patricia Murphy joins me on Monday. She, of course, is the political reporter and columnist, political insider columnist for the AJC. You read her on Wednesdays and Sundays when she publishes her column, but she also oversees The Jolt at AJC.com every day. And Patricia, you are joining us as any good reporter would do with a campaign, with an election looming, from your car, waiting to cover some campaign events. Yes.
Yes, I am. I'm in the Olive Garden parking lot in Rome, Georgia, but it's not open yet. But yes, I'll be spending the day on the campaign trail in the 14th district, which I am really looking forward to.
Yeah, I'll bet you are. Well, thank you for being here today. It's great to have you with us. Andre Gillespie is back with us today, professor of political science and director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory. Andre, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm terrific. After a day of watching debates yesterday, as you did as well, I'm looking forward to talking about all of them. Alan Abramowitz, your colleague from Emory University, is also here. Alan, you are now an emeritus professor of political science at Emory University. I think you're down to having to teach one course each semester. You'd finished one, I think, just now, and you teach another in the fall, right?
Right, and I don't even have to do that. Voluntary. They don't force me to teach a class.
Wow,
it's
I like
something
that.
It's something that's enjoyable to do, though. I get to occasionally interact with my colleagues.
And we're glad you continue to be a panelist on Political Rewind. Kurt Young, who is the chairman of the Political Science Department at Clark Atlanta University and also teaches political science there. Kurt, I get to see you on WebEx. Because we all look at each other, even though our listeners can't see you. You are looking especially cool today, Kurt. You've got a Kangol. It looks like a Kangol to me, which I think of as a Sam Jackson hat. You're looking great, Kurt.
Well, Bill, if you can look at me and tell that I'm wearing a Kangol, that means you're pretty cool, too.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Let's get right to it. Patricia, let's talk about early voting just for a couple of minutes, because I think it's important that people understand that voting does begin today. Patricia, we know that SB 202 was enormously controversial. Many people feel that any number of the provisions in that measure could suppress the vote. But we also should say there are some things about the bill that people should be aware of that, in fact, are good changes in the law. For instance, it is now a law that early voting hours have to be set from between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., and counties can offer up to 12 hours of a daily early voting from 7 in the morning to 7 at night. It used to be just had to have early voting during business hours, which were never defined. We also now have two Saturdays of early voting and can have potentially, depending on the county, two Sunday days. So there are some things about it that if people want to vote early, they can take advantage of those things in a positive way. Yes, Patricia?
Yes, and when Republicans defend SB 202, they will talk a lot about these changes. I think probably the most important is that requirement to do nine to five voting. That was not defined, and so in some smaller counties, it would be maybe 10 to 3. You know, it didn't have to be anything in particular. And so this gives voters predictability, but it does not preclude counties from doing, 7 to 7, which is what we see in most larger metro counties. Another big difference, which is a major criticism from Democrats, is that drop boxes will be inside polling places and available only during polling hours. And that's a big change from 2020, when people could drop off their ballot outside of drop boxes, in some cases 24 hours a day. Those were locked. They were under video surveillance. There was a lot of misinformation about the security of those drop boxes. But if anybody voted with the drop box last time around, they will see some changes this time around. And so we have a full write-up from Mark Nisi about the changes that voters will physically see and feel during early voting at theajc.com. So they can check that out as well.
Yeah, and he's done a good job of that. We should also point out, Kurt, that voters have to be aware of other changes that may not be so beneficial to them. You have to require an absentee ballot no later than 11 days before Election Day, May 24th. So you've got to push forward if you're going to get an absentee ballot. Patricia already mentioned drop boxes are limited. Not only are they inside polling places now, but there are fewer drop boxes around the state. So all of this is to say that as voters start looking to casting ballots, they really need to be aware of what these changes might mean. The other thing I'll point out, Kurt, is you now have to have a paper document with your absentee ballot request, which means you have to have access to a printer to print out that paper. Kurt?
Yeah, and all of these new challenges are items that, as Patricia mentioned, are being targeted, mentioned, emphasized by the Democrats as to the shortcomings of SB 202, right? And then when you look at it from that perspective, you see how critical it becomes attached to the Democratic effort to get out all of the votes as possible, right? And so you're going to find, starting now, but I think it'll ramp up as we get closer and closer to the general, you'll begin to find much more emphasis on connecting these types of issues to the get out the vote strategy.
One of the things that I think is actually interesting for us to be able to look at is that while this is a test of what SB 202 is going to do, we really have to look ahead to the November election. The types of people who are going to be participating in this election are people who are probably well acquainted with the election system. And even though they have to get used to new rules, right, are probably in a really strong position to be able to navigate the new rules, because these are high propensity voters who show up usually in primary elections. So I think we need to be careful about making some apples to oranges comparisons about trying to compare what primary election results are going to look like compared to, would have happened in November 20 or 21 versus what we could see happen in the fall.
Alan?
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. And the other thing to keep in mind with the turnout in the primary is that we're likely to see a much larger turnout for the Republican primary than for the Democratic primary, simply because Republicans have this contested primary for governor. And at the top of the ticket, the Democratic contest, the high-profile contests are uncontested, so that Stacey Abrams is not being challenged. Raphael Warnock is not being challenged. So there are contests further down the ballot, but I don't think they're going to attract nearly as great a turnout. So my prediction is that we're going to see a very disproportionate Republican turnout, but not necessarily because of SB 202, but because simply of the fact that the Republicans have these high-profile primary contests going on, the Democrats don't.
Absolutely. Alan, but while we're talking about turnout, you have maintained on this show and elsewhere for some time now that while SB 202 while there may be some reasons to believe that the measures could suppress some of the potentially Democratic vote, you've said for a long time you believe that, in fact, people could end up being more energized. Now, again, as Andra and you point out, not necessarily in the primary where you don't have top of the ballot contest, but down the road, you still think it might work to the favor of Democrats who are going to be much more energized to vote. You still feeling that way?
Well, I think what you're going to see is that when we get to the general election, that there's going to be a much more of an organized effort to mobilize Democratic voters using SB 202 as one of the issues. Because what happens normally when if a political party's message to a group of voters is, we really would prefer that you don't vote, please stay at home, they don't necessarily respond by accepting that and saying, yeah, you know, it's going to be too difficult, we're just not going to bother voting. That you'll see a redoubled effort, I think, to get people out to vote. And I don't think things like putting drop boxes inside of precincts instead of outside, or even changing the early voting hours is going to have much impact on that. The research on early voting in particular tends to show that it has no effect on turnout anyway, that the availability of early voting and the number of days of early voting don't increase turnout. It makes it easier to vote. It's popular. But it doesn't actually increase turnout.
Okay, let's move on and talk a little bit about the debates. By the way, as Patricia pointed out, Mark Nisi at AJC.com has information about voting. We do too at GPB.org. Stephen Fowler's written a piece which will give you information that you need. And Natalie Mendenhall is going to tweet out some links that you can use to the Secretary of State's office as early voting gets underway. Patricia. So we saw yesterday another debate for governor, different this time because it wasn't just David Perdue versus Brian Kemp. It included all of the candidates for governor. And in some way, that was kind of the cooling saucer in otherwise very hot cups of debate tea before when it was Kemp and Perdue just going against each other. Yes.
That's exactly right. Yes, there were five candidates on stage instead of two. And so, you know, it's like it kind of makes awkward one-on-one appearances less awkward if you bring a friend along. There were five candidates on stage. So the Kemp-Perdue factor was significantly diluted. And also, I found it fascinating that the panelists asking the questions did not ask about the 2020 election. I think that was important because it put on the table a number of other issues that, you know, from the economy to the Rivian deal out in east of Atlanta to a number of other issues that I think Republican voters care about. While previous debates had specifically asked about the 2020 elections, this debate did not. And so it really changed the tenor of that race. And then also, I think for Governor Kemp, he is happy to give some of the spotlight away to others because he is doing very well in the polls right now. Candace Taylor is a woman who Republican activists are very familiar with. I think she had a number of lines that the far right conservative activists will appreciate, maybe to the detriment of David Perdue, but we will see what happens and how this all shakes out. But it was a very different dynamic last night, I thought, definitely, for that reason.
I think one of the questions, Kurt, and then I'd love to get everybody else in on this, is we do know that the polling suggests that David Perdue and Kemp are the only two who have a real shot at winning this thing. And Kemp is positioned maybe to win without a runoff. Here's the question I want to start with on that, Kurt. Has Kemp done enough in this final debate as we look forward to the election moving forward to the 24th? Did he do enough yesterday to fight off David Perdue's challenge? Or did the other candidates, in fact, put themselves in a position, as perhaps Patricia suggests, maybe, to force this thing into a runoff?
Well, you know, there are no guarantees. His campaign would certainly like to position itself as such. But, you know, we've been talking about this for some time, Bill. We have to be a bit more cautious these days in reading these polls. And so while the conventional wisdom is that he seems to be poised to glide into the general, we don't know for certain, especially when we just suppose the current debate around or as they're connected to some of the national issues around the place of Georgia in the upcoming elections, right? And when we think about it, by Trump playing such a prominent role in these types of primaries, you may find that individuals may shift based upon the Trump endorsement. Now, of course, this is a signal as to the strength of Trump's endorsement, and I think the state of Georgia, as well as a number of states, will tell us a bit more about the power of the Trump endorsement. But I do believe that there's something lingering out there that we're not quite sure about in terms of whether or not Kemp can glide forward. And I think that Perdue and others who are gaining Trump endorsements are hoping that endorsement is going to carry the day. And the last one I'll make, Bill, is that this is sort of personal for Trump. And I suspect that he is, and I think we've already received reports that he is going to ramp up his support for Perdue as he lashes out even more intensely towards Kemp.
Alan, we do know that Trump is having a tele rally for Perdue tonight. Talked about maybe coming back one more time in person. On the other hand, he gave the New York Times an interview in which he once again hedged his bets about David Perdue and suggested maybe Perdue can't win this thing.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, I think that's a good example of Trump being Trump. So he wants to have it both ways. You know, he'd like to claim credit for the success of any of his candidates that he's endorsed. And we don't forget, there's a big primary coming up in Ohio. Tomorrow also, where we'll see another test of Trump's influence on the Republican Party, maybe a more clear-cut test because there's no incumbent running in that Senate primary there. And I think it's certainly, as Kirk said, you know, we need to be careful about reading too much into these polls, especially in a primary. So polls in primary elections are notoriously inaccurate, or at least, if not inaccurate, at least there can be big shifts in a relatively short period of time. That's something you don't generally see in a general election where voters are tied to their party. But in a primary election where voters are choosing within the same party, you can get pretty big swings. In this case, however, I would say because Kemp is an incumbent governor, very well known, that's less likely. We're less likely to see big shifts over the last few weeks. And I think he's in a pretty strong position right now to avoid a runoff.
Andra?
So I agree that Kemp is in a strong position, but he's not so far over the hump that statistically like 49 or 50 isn't part of what the sort of range of possible kind of true values are. While I can't say that one of the sort of the third, fourth, or the fifth candidate isn't going to be spoiler, I also don't think that they really have a shot of winning. In their own heads, they do. Candace Taylor talked about that a lot, but like she's not going to win. And one of the things that was actually really interesting was to see in some ways how they position themselves relative to Kemp and Perdue in ways that were interesting. So Taylor played a lot to conspiracy theories. So she mentioned pedophilia, sort of a clear QAnon kind of reference. She said that Kemp was, you know, being controlled by the Communist Party of China. Because of his support of Rivian. Like, these are things that don't make you particularly marketable as a general election candidate. And even with a very conservative Republican electorate in Georgia, I'm not sure that that's actually going to appeal to the median Republican voter in the state. So, I mean, it was also interesting to see Catherine Davis, somebody who has run for office before, who was basically running as a pro-life activist. African-American woman, not to say that she wouldn't necessarily support whoever the Republican nominee is, that she'd have to weigh her conscience. And so, I mean, to see the contrast was actually really interesting. On the other hand, I don't think it changes the overall dynamic that this is a race between Kemp and Perdue that Kemp is leading in.
Patricia, before we move on, I did think, Andra referred to it, Candace Taylor, who I have not been exposed to much because her campaign has not gotten a great deal of attention, although she's third kind of in the polling, although the numbers are very insignificant. She called President Biden a pedophile as Andra points out, she said that Brian Kemp was in bed basically with the Communist Party of China. And, you know, despite the fact that we have seen a lot of this right-wing rhetoric expressed more and more often, there was something still startling on the stage of a gubernatorial debate to hear that kind of language.
Yes, when she said that to Joe Biden, I myself, not to Joe Biden, but about Joe Biden, I was shocked because I actually have not heard anybody else on a debate stage or on the national stage say that about Joe Biden in particular. But we do know that this is a part of the extreme wing of the Republican Party here in Georgia. I think that Marjorie Taylor Greene is a big piece of that. Andrew Clyde is a piece of that. There is an audience for the most extreme, most histrionic, most accusatory base instincts out there. And so I think that's why Candace Taylor has a small but loyal following. That's why Donald Trump has a large but loyal following. And I think the Republican Party is really going to have to sort itself out. After this election, there's going to need to be some significant soul searching happening, because even if Brian Kemp does get through his primary, with or without a runoff, there is this piece of the party that is very loud, vocal, strong, and in some cases are electing members to Congress and are having, you know, a significant say about the direction of the party and the state. And so, you know, well, Brian Kemp be the last of his kind who can get a statewide approval without getting in the mud like that? I'm not sure. We'll have to see where they go after this.
By the way, one of the points that Marjorie Taylor Greene made in her debate yesterday was that when if Republicans take control of Congress, the House, she expects to get some top committee assignments. She says that Kevin McCarthy has already promised them to her. So that just reinforces some of what you're saying about the right wing of the party and its place now within the overall party. Andra, I want to play a soundbite from the 10th District Republican debate, because I think it tells us so much about where we stand right now in much of our politics. This is Mike Collins, could be, you know, the leading candidate in that race. He certainly has been positioning himself against Vernon Jones. Let's listen to one of the things he said, and then I want you all to comment on it, starting with you, Andra.
So if you are looking for someone that is truly pro-Trump, an America First agenda candidate, someone that'll stand up not only to the lunatic left over there, but to the rhinos, the elites, and the establishment in our own party, I need your help. Because, you see, the time for compromise, the time for bipartisanship, that's over with.
Andra, the time for bipartisanship is over with. That, too, is a startling comment.
It was startling, and as I was watching this debate, I was thinking about how I could use that in my class to talk about things. And so what I heard was, you know, Alan Abramowitz sort of rendering of negative partisanship here. And so it's this idea that the other folks are othered, and that you can't work with them, you can't deal with them. Like, that's the extension of negative partisanship going on there. That was definitely stark. You know, I think in some ways that was a bar, because if I recall, it was him who was going back and forth all the time with Vernon Jones, you know, basically trying to say Vernon Jones is, you know, a Democrat who's just being an opportunist and kind of coming over here to our side. So he was attempting to discredit him through that debate as well. But yes, I mean, I think it does reflect where we are in our polarization today. People think that compromise is a dirty word. Marjorie Taylor Greene thinks that getting 80% of what she wants in a bill as opposed to 100% is grounds to vote against the bill, even if it hurts her constituents. And that came up during the 14th district debate. Mm-hmm. So I think we are sort of at a place where we think it is okay to elect inflexible people who will cut off their nose to spite their face.
Alan, you are the author. Oh, go ahead, Kurt. Go ahead.
Oh, by the way, Kurt, let Kurt go first. Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
No. I wanted to connect with what Andra said just a moment ago. You know, Bill. You know, there's something happening here in the Republican Party. There's an emerging split. I think if there's one thing that we can tell from the recently released text messages around the January 6th Commission, and to be continued, right? Because those things seem to be flowing out on a daily basis. But what I think is reflecting is that there's an emerging and perhaps already existing major chasm in the Republican Party. And as long as that split exists, if we are correct and that split exists, it's going to manifest itself in more intense forms of these types of tendencies, right? On the one hand, this demonizing of the entire other party. You only have two major parties in the American body politic. And you have one party which has decided that not only is it that the other party is its opponent, but that other party is illegitimate and open to all types of the most vile types of conspiracies that one could think of. Who would have ever imagined that it would become a typical part of one party's, I don't want to even use the word platform because it's actually occurring in the absence of a serious platform, but would take a national and then by extension state and local a tone of questioning whether or not the opposing party and particularly its party leader is a pedophile. This is where we are right now. Now, I would argue Alan, that the only way that we get to what I heard Patricia make, which is a key point, that this has to change at some point, and don't let me put words in your mouth, Patricia, but something has to, there must be some kind of reckoning, is for there to be some bridge to be built between these parties to agree to some kind of approach forward that would be what we call bipartisanship, right? Mm-hmm. And I just don't see if that's going to unfold in the near future. I'm sorry, Alan.
No problem. I agree with everything you just said. I think it's important to keep in mind when we talk about this growing divide and about growing polarization, that while we see it in both parties, that it's really asymmetrical in that the Republican Party has, both in Georgia and nationally, really has moved much further to the right than the Democratic Party has moved to the left. There are certainly voices on the far left within the Democratic Party. They don't have the sort of influence and visibility and clout within the Democratic Party that the far right has within the Republican Party today and has had for a while. You know, there's a reason why Donald Trump chose Mark Meadows as his chief of staff. Mark Meadows came right out of the Freedom Caucus. The far right wing of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives, but those were Trump's most trustworthy allies. Those were the people he knew would stand with him through thick and thin and through impeachment struggles. And we're seeing that continue now. And this delegitimization of the opposition party, this delegitimization of elections is a very dangerous thing. But again, it's happening on one side. And that's largely because I think of two things that are going on that are different when we compare the two parties. One is that the rank and file are being led in that direction by party leaders who are making these sorts of arguments, specifically Donald Trump, of course. We don't have no one like that on the Democratic side who is making these sort of arguments about conspiracy theories. And the other is the influence of Fox News. There's nothing like that on the left, and we should not underestimate the significance of that. The New York Times has just done this series on the rise of Tucker Carlson and his influence both within Fox News and on the audience of Fox News. Tucker Carlson is the most watched political commentator on television today. That's a scary thing if you look at the messaging that's coming from him. And there's nothing like that on the left. There's no one who has that kind of influence on the left who is making those kinds of arguments. So it's asymmetrical, even though certainly we're seeing a pulling apart in both directions.
Patricia?
Yeah, I think for Democrats, their own divisions are being a little bit papered over right now by the fact that they have these two longtime leaders at the head of the party with Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden. They are both to be off the scene relatively soon by dint of their age. I think we will see that a similar split within the Democrats really erupt over the direction of that party as well and the future of that moderate middle for Democrats and Republicans. And what I've been struck by Republicans this cycle is that with somebody like Mike Collins, whose own father was in Congress, the fight is not just with Democrats. It's not just the Democrats who are the other. It's the moderate Republicans who are not even moderate. Like, Brian Kemp is not moderate, but they have made people who don't support Donald Trump the enemy. It's they are also the enemy. They are also the people that they are running against. And so it's not just, which party are you in? It's have you supported Donald Trump enough to sort of win approval of that section of the party? And again, we'll see if Brian Kemp can pull out this primary, that could change the momentum in the state, but we'll see.
Sambar Mostaz is frantically waving at me to get a break in. And so I want to do that. I do want to point out as we go to break, by the way, though, that Vernon Jones also raised this specter of the other side being the enemy. One of his arguments yesterday was, I'm going to impeach Joe Biden if I'm elected to the 10th district. We've got to pause for a moment. We'll be back with more on Political Rewind. Kurt Young, Alan Abramowitz, Andra Gillespie, Patricia Murphy join me for Political Rewind today. I just want to say very briefly before we move forward and kind of the context of the discussion we were having before the break. You know, David Ralston was on the show on Friday, and I thought Ralston went further than he has before in talking about Donald Trump in quite negative terms. And in fact, later we learned from his office that he would have been interested in continuing to talk more about his concerns about the influence Trump is having on certainly on the Georgia Republican Party and beyond. And I think that's a fascinating aspect of where the speaker's at right now. And Andra, with that in mind, let's talk a little more about the Trump influence, just briefly about this Ohio primary coming up tomorrow. This is a huge test, as Alan referred to earlier, of Donald Trump's influence, where he has endorsed J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy. And at the same time, you've got Ted Cruz up there campaigning on behalf of the other major candidate, one of the other two, Josh Mandel. If Trump doesn't win this, what does it mean about his influence in the weeks and months ahead?
Well, I mean, I think that there's always going to be a discussion. I think we're going to have it for years about whether or not the emperor had any clothes on to begin with. And so I'm going to think about this in the context of sort of the aggregate. So I'm not concerned about one-off here. If like there's any chance for Trump to have a one-off effect, it's probably in Ohio, because J.D. Vance, the never Trumper, was pretty much plucked from obscurity and kind of given the patina of having the Trump endorsement at a time when he needed it. And so it does on the surface look like Trump has an effect there. And I probably like won't challenge that. But in general, it like we may find, and again, this is an empirical question that we have to test later, right? He doesn't necessarily have the same type of impact. So one of the questions that we would think about if we were putting this in a model is, you know, is it that Trump's effect works in certain kinds of contests versus not open seat versus incumbent races, right? If it does it work for novice candidates versus those who are already politically established before Trump, right? The things that may be helping Vance out here is that he's a novice candidate who needed to kind of clean up his advance wins with Trump's support. That doesn't mean that actually travels well into other contexts.
We lost just a little bit of your comments. I'm sorry to say, Andra, but I got the gist of them. Alan, weigh in on this Ohio primary and how important it is for Trump to get J.D. Vance across the finish line. His endorsement did seem to bump Vance up in the numbers a bit.
It did. Yeah, I think Trump has made endorsements in a lot of races around the country. And he's made endorsements in down ballot races here in Georgia, too. And in some way, I think in the Secretary of State's race, that could be a more pure test of Trump's influence than in the governor's race, where he's going up against an incumbent who's pretty popular with Republican voters. So I think that's a tough one. Ohio, yes, his endorsement of J.D. Vance, I think, will be interesting. In Pennsylvania later, with Dr. Oz. The interesting thing in Ohio is Trump can't even seem to remember the name of the candidate that he endorsed. So yesterday, made a statement in which he referred to J.D. Vance as J.D. He referred to J.D. Mandel, I think, confusing him with the other leading candidate there, Josh Mandel. who is also was vying very, very, you know, vying very strongly for the Trump endorsement, and who is running as a very much of an ally of Donald Trump. So, you know, if J.D. Vance loses to Josh Mandel, yes, I mean, that would be an endorsement that failed. But on the other hand, if Josh Mandel is the nominee, he's just as much of a Trumper as every bit the Trumper that J.D. Vance. In fact, for a longer time, J.D. Vance is a sort of Johnny J.D. come lately, you might say, to the Trump world. But I have, you know, I'm just thinking about what is the future here? What's going to happen if Republicans take control of Congress, at least the House of Representatives, which looks pretty likely? You know, what? How are they going to govern? You know, with this collection of crazies in their caucus, and with Kevin McCarthy as the Speaker of the House, and I hope we get a chance to talk about this because I think that in some ways, having a Republican-controlled Congress, or at least a Republican-controlled House of Representatives, could be the best thing that could possibly happen to Joe Biden when it comes to his chances of being reelected in 2024.
So I see 2022 not really as a measure of Trump's influence, but as a measure of his judgment and the team around him. I think that he is making these really a lot of cases emotional, fact-free, really stupid endorsements just out of pure knee-jerk reaction. When he was in the White House, he had more of a team around him. He had a full political team. They couldn't override his override his judgment in all cases. But at this point, he is really in Mar-a-Lago, as far as we know, and just sending out tweets. I mean, these candidates in Georgia didn't know it was coming until it happened. In many cases, in other cases, he recruited people just out of pure spite. And so this has his endorsement has always been a questionable influence. He endorsed Roy Moore over in Alabama, and the Democrat won that Senate seat. It served the purpose of having Roy Moore win the primary because Trump was in it, but then lose the general election because he himself was also a terribly damaged candidate. So I think that this continues to show the slate that he has picked in Georgia continues to show he doesn't have an operation around him and doesn't have the judgment to be making these informed decisions.
But Patricia, before we hand it off, I want to get Kurt in here. But before I do, I think what Alan just said about a Republican-controlled House is interesting. You certainly were up there and saw what happens when a group of conservative Republicans, the House Freedom Caucus, creates nothing but trouble for the Speaker, for two Speakers of the House in a row. And I think if McCarthy is successful in becoming Speaker, he's already had people like Marjorie Taylor Greene warn him about how he had better toe the line on right-wing credentials. So you have an experience that will probably play into what could happen in the fall.
Well, if McCarthy wins the speakership, he is the most purely political animal I've ever seen, and he will read his caucus to understand how he will continue his speakership. And so if his caucus continues to be so controlled by Donald Trump, that's the direction that Kevin McCarthy is going to go in. So I think we can expect a Trump-infused Republican majority, particularly with the 2024 elections on the horizon. And Donald Trump has made very well known that he is planning to run for reelection. And so I think that I do think that that would be a great development for Democrats. I think that that is why Democrats won in Georgia in the first place, is because Donald Trump was so involved in the process. And so I think Democrats would like to have a foil to run against other than inflation. They would really love to have Donald Trump back on the scene to give voters the option. Do you really want to go back this direction again?
Kurt?
You know, Bill, there's something interesting that I'm hearing. When you listen to Josh Mandel and his response to what seems to be a surprise support by of J.D. Vance, you don't hear him and other candidates for that matter, in a sense, turn their fire on Trump, although there is a debate within the party. What are they doing? They are, although they don't have the endorsement, they are still speaking to Trump, and they're still trying to find ways to express their bona fides as it relates to Trump. Now, why is that the case? Why are they still trying to find some kind of relationship with Trump as the election goes forward. It is because it's not only there's a lot of talk about Trump as a cult of personality. That's a powerful point. But where does that register? That becomes a prominent point in terms of the Trump voter, not necessarily the Trump candidate, the Trump voter. And as long as that perception is there, that the Trump voter will remain active and remain a powerful political force in the upcoming election, then you're going to find the continued looming power of Trump himself in party politics. I think there's one thing that can change that, and that might be, and this is just something that's speculation, but that might be an indictment of Trump and something that plays out in the legal process that changes the landscape altogether. But I don't know that the endorsement by itself is enough to indicate what's going to happen in the upcoming elections.
Well, your talk about a possible indictment of Trump is where we're going to go in just a minute when we talk about another very big story today, the impaneling of the special grand jury by Fannie Willis. But before we get there and before we have to take a break again, Andra, I can't help it. It's sort of, I was really intrigued when you talked about the way you look at data for what Trump's power can be moving forward, how you're going to crunch it. And I do think, do you think it's possible that we're going to get to the end of 2022, and if things don't go the way Trump hopes they will, it'll kind of burst that boil that the Republican Party that has been festering, that it could be a turning point and that Trump's importance moving forward into 23 and beyond will be diminished?
Well, I don't think Trumpism is going away. I mean, I think a lot of the sort of ideals, the stances, the playing towards the cultural wars, the, you know, some of the things that we don't think about that often with Trumpism, like deregulation, I think those things are here to stay with us for the foreseeable future. Where I think it could happen is that, and I would be very curious to talk to Speaker Ralston on May 25th, if Brad Raffensperger and if Brian Kemp win their races. Right. I think that what you heard Speaker Ralston say on Friday might actually kind of be a little bit more voluble and a lot louder at that time, where some people will still be willing to stand up. So while, you know, I think that the fever may start to break, I don't think you'd actually get to the point where the Republican Party would be in a cold sweat and really kind of over the fever sort of, you know, at the end of this year, if Donald Trump's candidates end up losing. I think there's still a ways to go before the Republican Party sort of is, you know, in their 2.0 phase.
Ellen, quick comment. Got to get to a break, but you first.
I want to go back to what Kurt said. I think what it really comes down to in terms of Trump's influence on the Republican Party is the Republican base. It comes down to the attitudes of rank-and-file Republican voters. And until they turn away from Trump, I don't think you're going to see the party's candidates and leaders really turn away from Trump, regardless of what happens in these primaries. And what we're seeing right now is that among the rank-and-file, Trump is still very popular, not quite as popular as he was perhaps, you know, a year or two ago, but he still has a lot of support there. And that's the key to his continuing influence on the Republican Party.
Okay, let's take our final break of the show and be back with more. Patricia Murphy, even as a New York grand jury that was impaneled late last year to hear evidence against Donald Trump and possible corruption was disbanded without any action whatsoever, Fannie Willis today starts to select members of her special grand jury to investigate whether Donald Trump, others like, I'm blocking the names of people who might be in her sights. You'll tell me. She's going to begin this process that could take a year. She's got a year with this special grand jury. What's the importance of it?
So I think it's hugely important. It's very distinct from what was happening in New York because the New York case had to do with Donald Trump's business contacts and business conduct. This has to do with directly with election interference here in Georgia and Donald Trump's effort in the January phone call with Brad Raffensperger and calling Raffensperger to tell him, look, I need 11,000 votes. You know, I have 11,000 votes. Go out there, and I just need to find 11,000 votes. And he, of course, meant to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The fact that it happened in a recorded phone call means that it is now public, but it doesn't mean it didn't happen and that it wasn't illegal, just because we all know about it. But she is has conducted a lengthy investigation to get to this point, to have a special grand jury impaneled, and it will be looking at Donald Trump, his associates, and other members of the Republican Party who may have worked with Donald Trump in an attempt to overturn that Georgia election. She'll have them, again, the special grand jury, for at least probably the next year, certainly after the 2022 elections, when we'll hear any results.
Yeah, let me, Kurt, say that in my senior moment, I wasn't thinking about the fact that David Schaefer could be on her radar, the chair of the Georgia Republican Party, because he impaneled a fake slate of Trump electors. Mm-hmm. Lindsey Graham could be in her sights because of a call he made to Raffensperger's office about the election. So this could go beyond Trump, Kurt.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's very interesting to see. We've been saying this over and over on this show, Bill, the extent to which the races in Georgia and the political issues in the state of Georgia become nationalized, right? And Georgia becomes the epicenter, not just of the political realities, but also of these legal realities that is gripping the country. But, you know, Bill, something else that's happening with Fannie Willis that I think is important to mention, and that is part, again, of the current political climate is the elevating of Black women at a position in leadership throughout the country. And maybe without her even asking for it, and with the decision, so it seems, in New York to move away from indicting Trump coming out of Alvin Bragg's office, it is now thrust the newest grand jury to the national spotlight again. And so whatever plays out, I think we have, in addition to our electing, our deselection of the first African-American woman to be seated on the high court, you're seeing again the important focus on women, Black women, in these kinds of discussions taking place now.
Andra?
You know, I think one of the things that's really interesting here is that the financial crimes might have been harder to prove. And that, you know, if this were another financial crimes case, it might actually look like a fool's errand. But because this one is elections related in an area where Trump is less conversant because he just didn't have enough experience and where there's videotaped evidence that everybody has heard that looks pretty damning from the outside, this is a different case. So, you know, I know that the Trump wing is going to call this a witch hunt, but it's just like, yeah, but no, like the circumstances and the facts around this case touch on a topic that is totally different from this. And unfortunately, right, we got you on tape saying so. So I think that this is interesting. It's also interesting that when we talk about this from a federalist standpoint, we see the January 6th committee is, you know, gearing up. They're going to have hearings next month. But, you know, if this is prolonged, we can expect that if Republicans take over the House of Representatives, that whatever isn't done is going to get shut down in the 118th Congress. But here you have state local government that's like, actually, we have purview over this one particular thing, an election in our state and a phone call that was made into Fulton County. And so therefore, we're going to exercise that right to, you know, exert some accountability and demand it in this particular area. I think it is a great lesson for all of us.
Alan, last word before we're out of time.
I absolutely agree with what Andra just said, that the significance of this is in the fact that it will continue into 2023, beyond the 2022 midterm elections, regardless of which party controls the House, regardless of what happens to the House committee investigation, which the Republicans almost certainly would shut down. Will Trump actually ultimately be held accountable for his behavior, for his actions? I don't know. I'm still pretty skeptical about that, but at least it means there's a chance of that happening.
Yeah, I do think I want to clarify, because you all have done a good job of it, actually. Certainly the New York grand jury is a whole different matter. But what many people are saying, Patricia, is that the Fannie Willis case is really the last opportunity that people who really want to see Trump held accountable for some sins that he may have committed. Mm-hmm. It's Fannie Willis who's got the ball finally in her court, right?
Well, the last that we know of. I think there, there will continue to be instances of Donald Trump and questionable legalities. But yes, and Fannie Willis is extremely meticulous. Her language is very reserved. She would not be doing this, I don't think, if she felt like the circumstances were there. And she said, I have to go after cases no matter who has committed the potential crime.
All right. We are completely out of time. Can I please have at least another hour with this panel? I wish I could. What a great way to start the week. Patricia Murphy, Andra Gillespie, Kurt Young, Ellen Abramowitz, thank you so much for a smart, really fascinating conversation. We're out of time for today's show. We'll be back, of course, tomorrow with another Political Rewind. In the meantime, my thanks to Jesse Neiswanger, to Natalie Mendenhall, and to Sam Burmistaz for the work you are doing behind the scenes to make Political Rewind the show it is. I'll see you all tomorrow. In the meantime, please take care and stay healthy. Bye, everybody.